Hello and welcome back to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we've been trying to isolate from Al for years in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, here we are again, and we are still unsure if and indeed when the season will ever get back underway. The club's position is clear. We want to finish the season, but the club has been resolute in the view that we don't want to play in neutral venues, but seem to have accepted the fact that whatever ground the game is played in, the ground will be empty. All the time people are still dying, football pales in significance, and also the safety of the players is paramount. We've said it before and we'll say it again, football isn't a TV show. Joining me today, as we try and make some sort of sense of the situation, is of course Alan Wares. And joining us from their isolation bunkers is Andy Bass, Marcus Hancocks, and of course Bill Shelley in the corner. Although,
hello, AD.
Hello, everyone. How are we all?
Say hello, everyone.
Yep. Hello.
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 AD, sort of more than anything, how are you, mate? You've got an entire clan load in your household. How's it going? How many of them are still alive and not throttled?
Well, I, let's put it this way: I don't have to rebuild a patio yet, but it's. I've realised there's a reason I'm not a teacher, so I've got the utmost respect for anyone in that profession, and of course, all of the young people that are still out there, the NHS, etc.
I'll tell Susie you said that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, the patience that is required to teach small people is I mean, I am completely in awe of all teachers.
Good man. You know,
these are very strange times. I said it in the intro there. I mean, football really isn't important all the time that people are dying, but the club seem to be, well, the Premier League in particular, seem to be desperate to get something back out there. What are our thoughts on this, Andy?
Well, to be honest, I'm finding the whole thing kind of unseemly, to be honest. My personal view is that we should null and void the season just because it's the simplest thing to do. I understand why the league wants to finish it, but I just think whatever form they manage to reconstitute what's left of this season is so far removed from what went on before. It's not the same competition, and it just seems like we're contorting ourselves for very little reason. I do think there's a chance that we could adequately prepare for starting next season somewhere approximately on time, either at the end of August or in September. Even if fans aren't in the stadium, at least we could start that competition on some sort of a level playing field. And we would need a long time to actually prepare for that. And I think we're just sort of diverting resources into doing something that really very few people actually really care about.
Yeah, now, Marcus, the view is about the safety of the players and supporters and everything is paramount. Now, the medical profession, the club doctors and everyone, they've all come out and said, well, we don't think it's safe to go back.
Yeah, exactly. So I agree with Andy, basically. In the season off, start again in August 2021, maybe say, for a whole season, the whole season's going to be played behind closed doors, so it's a level playing field for everybody from day one. But as far as this season's concerned, just can it and bin it. Got to be honest, if it wasn't for Leeds and Liverpool, it probably would be. It's as simple as that. That's my personal opinion, but that's probably more closer to the truth than anything else. Some of the players don't really want to start it at the moment. They've still got their concerns, and without getting too political, if people start saying, oh, yeah, but Germany are starting soon. Well, Germany have got a better handle on the crisis that's currently here than we have. So,
yeah, who knew the Germans would get it
well
right?
Well done, Germany, for your, testing, tracking, tracing, and virtually, doing everything by the book. We are light years behind it. So we are in no way ready to start, closed doors or no closed doors. But as Andy says, maybe from next season, you could start it in, say, September, maybe bin off the domestic competitions and just play the whole league behind closed doors, which, you know, by then it should be a safer environment than it is at the moment.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, obviously, I mean, we're going to talk about the comments that have come out of the club, the press conference with Paul Barber and Dan Ashworth yesterday, which was really enlightening. So if you get a chance, go and check that out. But the thing is that the prospect of playing games behind closed doors, I mean, this is something that is used as a punishment by UEFA, which probably doesn't mean a lot, really, does it? But it's meant to be there as a threat that if your fans badly behave, you will not play with your fans in the stadium. That's seen as a punishment. So it's not a level playing field if that's how they want to do it to finish the season.
But the point you've got here is that I don't think it's unreasonable for the Premier League and the individual clubs and anyone who's a willing sort of shareholder in football generally to actually consider all options. It's just that what seems to be happening is that all options are being considered in public, and some of them are just being fabricated by the press and the media. You know, when you've got the whole idea of a neutral venue or behind closed doors or up in space or in a vat of jam or whatever it might be, you know, all these things are considered. And even then, considering what other countries are doing isn't necessarily one of the same. As Marcus said, we don't have the same method of doing and getting through the lockdown in the same way that other countries have run theirs. So you've got that to consider. And Paul, you know, all that the clubs seem to be talking about is what they're not keen on doing, which is playing behind closed doors. Because if you've got three quarters of the season played in front of everyone and a quarter of it not, well, okay, fine, but you've got to know that you're going to do that at the beginning of the season. Of course, it can't and doesn't work that way.
I mean, I've got
so
a
you're
quote.
You're going to have the whole season doing one thing or not at all. So in that sense, I mean, it's kind of interesting hearing. I didn't realise that Andy and Marcus were so keen on having the whole thing binned off. That, you know, in terms of fairness, yes, it would be the case because you are now denigrating the competition by adding in arbitrary considerations for how a match is staged. And home and away thing, I mean, it means we're then back to that old adage of football without fans is nothing. And if you have an empty stadium, I appreciate your point about it being the same as a punishment, but, you know, it's also a safety thing. So you have to look at it in those terms as well. What the point is I don't think anyone's come up with a completely one size fits all argument to say how the season can carry on while keeping the credibility of the competition going. I don't think that's going to happen, in which case there is a massive argument for binning it a whole lot off. But, you know, we've got meetings coming up with Cobra and let's see what the government are going to say about that. But I think that even then, bearing in mind that there is an awful lot more science to football than there was, say, even 20 years ago, I think that the football has within itself to be led by the science rather than the money this time round. And in that sense, I just hope that the science wins out.
Yeah, and as I said earlier, the doctors aren't keen. Our club doctor and all the club doctors are saying it's not necessarily safe for the players to go back. They're going to be in close contact. I'm going to use Glenn's example here of a corner, a typical corner where everyone's shopping, everyone's you know, they're sweating, they're all over each other, they're pulling, they're tugging, they're trying to get an advantage. How is that
that's
going to manifest itself? I mean, you're going to tell players, with the best will in the world, you can tell the players not to do that. But when they're on the pitch, all of that goes out the window. They're just going to play what is natural to them.
Well, you're effectively writing football to a new set of rules. And again, that will completely undo. If you're going to have a whole season where you're going to have, 2 metre distancing, which isn't possible. Football is a contact sport and that's the end of it. Yeah. So the whole notion of staying 2 metres apart at any time during this, you know, it's just not going to happen. It can't. And so, you know, it completely undoes the whole point of what football is.
I appreciate what you're saying about that. The thought of playing football, I'm sure that the concept of playing, whether it's behind closed doors or neutral venues or whatever, the proviso is that all the players are tested and don't have it. Therefore, those issues of close quarters are irrelevant if they don't have it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the only way they could even begin to do that. I know Glenn was saying, you know, when you're up for a corner and that, well, as you said, Alan, it's a contact sport. It's never going to not be. You can't play it with a 2 metre distance. I have to say, I think actually it goes without saying that if they're going to play it again, then all the players on the pitch will have been tested and proven not to have it. Mm-hmm. So that play 100% or as 100% as you could in an empty stadium. Personally, as I have my point, I think write the whole season off. I think 30,000 people dead is more than enough to satiate the people who would say, well, what about relegations and promotions? Get over yourselves, 30,000
people. That's the entire capacity of the MX, what it's for.
Yeah. It's shocking when you think about it. I mean, I did put the thing up the other day about it. You cannot actually envisage, when you know that there's 30,000 people, 30,000 people, including all the staff, all the players, all the management, everyone associated within a football stadium on a Saturday night afternoon, absolutely everyone never coming home. Yeah. You can't actually sort of get your head around the scale of things. You know, and as we go on, you're going to go from, well, the Amex size to next one, Southampton. The next one after that will be Sunderland's ground. And after that, so long as we don't get to the size of Old Trafford, dear God.
Mm. I think the thing is that the talk of recommencing it, I'm firmly in the scrap the season. Get over yourselves, whether you're a Leeds fan, a Norwich fan, a Liverpool fan, or a team that wants to come up from the conference. Get over yourselves. Look at the statistics that's been going on, being told to us every day at 5 o'clock, it ain't important. And sod the money. If there's a Premier League club that's going to go bust out of it, well, frankly, that's their own fault because the amount of money they've got. Mm. The other clubs that need support, well, hopefully there is support coming for them. And if you really want some kind of recompense to it, when it is safe to start a new season, whether it's behind closed doors or with fans in the stadium, every team in every league at every level starts the season on 50% of the points they've accrued this season.
Mm. Well, maybe. So, I mean, let's not throw too many confusions into it, but you actually raise another point, or you think of another point, and I'll throw this over to Andy and Marcus. If you're going to bin off the season three quarters of the way through, do you think you're entitled to compensation for, one quarter of your season ticket?
I'm not screaming for it. If the season next season goes ahead behind closed doors, then absolutely. But yeah. I've already kind of written off the money for this season anyway, because it's there's more important things going on at the moment than worrying about whether football fixtures are going, millionaires are going to be running around chasing a football. As far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Let's just bring this back a little bit, because I mean, obviously, there is this clamour from various people to get the games back on, get it started. Who is driving that? Because it's like it seems that it's not necessarily it's the TV companies who are driving this.
But the thing I would say about that is that the TV companies want their want to have sport to show on their channels. But they're not... Sky and BT, domestically, cannot operate without football. So they're not going to pull the plug when it restarts for next season. I think there will be a next season. Because they can't... They're not really in a position to sort of, punish the Premier League. Because they need the money more than the teams do, in my view. I mean, I think, if football didn't have the broadcast money, it would just recalibrate and you'd still have footballers out there. They just wouldn't be earning as much money, but people would still be going to watch it, because that's the experience. Like AD said, it's not a TV show. It's for people that attend it and people that really love it, they go. It's funny. I did that. I don't know if anyone has watched some of the K-League clash between the Suwon Bluebirds, Blue Wings, and the other team that I can't pronounce.
Are you making this up now?
It was really rubbish.
That's probably the standard of football as well.
I wouldn't say the sound of football was that bad, but the visual experience of watching them be kicking around in a very impressive looking stadium. I don't know. I mean, I don't think football's a good sport to watch with few people in the stadium. I mean, I could watch a baseball game that hasn't got many people in, because quite often, like certainly for like the midweek, the afternoon games, you can watch a Major League Baseball game, and there'll only be a few thousand people in there anyway, and it doesn't seem that unnatural. Like county cricket, you could watch, or Test cricket, even you could watch with few people there because it's not an unnatural experience. But football thrives on the atmosphere and the presence of people. You know, even if it's 500 people in a small ground like, Worthing or Lewis or Whitehawk, it's just like the presence of those people make the game what it is.
Without a bit of applause and cheering and swearing and stuff, I mean, the swearing at the ref or the opposition players or whatever, without a bit of that going on at a football game from whatever the size of the crowd is, what's there to enthuse the players?
Yeah.
This is the whole point of it, is that when television actually wants to put on its football matches, part of what it wants to do is it wants to do the whole thing, the whole thing is a fait accompli. In other words, they're putting on their version of theatre with a full house. I mean, so when for instance, Newcastle play Brighton and it's at, quarter to eight on a Monday evening, knowing full well that Newcastle can't get down and back, or vice versa, they do this every time. It's always Brighton, Newcastle. When was the last time we played Newcastle on a 3 o'clock on a Saturday? I digress.
Today.
Sorry? Today.
Today.
Yeah. Hang on, it's not Saturday.
All right.
It is bizarrely on TV a lot, Brighton, Newcastle.
Well, that probably not now. Chris Hughton's not with us. I think that's probably not going to be a TV. It was always a Chris Hughton thing with pushing us around with Newcastle.
Maybe.
I don't know, because it was the FA Cup game where Landy scored that goal. Chris Hughton wasn't the manager then, was he?
No, but I think that was more, we were in a championship, giant killing type. I don't know. Yeah.
Anyway. No, I mean, the point I'm making is, I mean, they just know that, Newcastle's a long way away. There's going to be London-based fans, but apart from that, we're not going to. But the point is that the TV companies always want a full house. And I think in Spain, even, there were clubs that got fined for not having 75% full stadiums. I can't remember
what they did. They took them to court on that, and if I remember rightly, what happened was is they said, well, you need to rearrange your season ticket holders so they all sit on one side of the pitch facing the cameras.
Brilliant.
So people got the bum ache about having to move their seats to go into a stand that wasn't where they preferred to. That, I think, actually the outcome of that for that very reason. I think that's not unique to Spain either. I think it may have happened elsewhere, where there's just to have the shot, and I think that's, again, that's part of the reason why so many people then watch the football on the telly. And if you've ever been overseas when there's been Premier League football on the TV in bars and stuff, it's quite astonishing. Where I used to go on holiday quite frequently, when there was a match on, you could walk along a row of bars, and every single bar has got the Man United game on or whatever, and they aren't going to watch it like that if it's behind closed doors, if it's got no one in the ground. I've just done a couple of pictures of that K-League game, and it just even when Renf game at the Amex, that made a difference having 1500 of us in there,
Yeah,
it was wonderful, wasn't it? Yeah. But okay, I mean, home advantage as well is something that is being talked about a lot. Paul Barr has been very, very vocal about how we are dead set against playing in a neutral venue and the integrity of the competition. We talk about having supporters in the stadium, which is obviously massive. But also the home advantage thing, you've got the travel element. You've got the, for instance, like what you talked about Newcastle there, Al. I mean, Newcastle would have been coming down this weekend. They would have had to travel the length of the country to get here. They'd have to stay overnight. They're not used to the pitch. They're not used to the dressing rooms. They're not used to the grass. Home advantage isn't just about the supporters. It's about a lot more than that.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Barbara is right to maintain his stance. I think, as much as we appear to be mostly agreeing on binning the season off, should they find a way to safely restart it, then that would be fine. Also, as long as it's you know, genuinely safe and whatnot. But you can't, you have to try and, we accept that fans can't be there, but you try and move it further and further away from what it was. The competition becomes meaningless. It then becomes like a 9 or 10 game season, and it's just, I don't know. It's just meaning. It's just, what's the point? It's not the same thing. It shows that you don't really care about the integrity of the competition.
Exactly. I think, all just to get Liverpool.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you have to maintain that. It's important for the long term, survival of the sport. I think, you know, otherwise, what's the point in watching it? If it just becomes this arbitrary mess.
Again, football's not a TV show.
Do it instead, you know.
I mean, Paul Barber is also, again, I've got a quote from him here. He says, "We can't support something that is going to put our club at a disadvantage." And this is about the plans to do this neutral venue thing, which is going to be discussed again at the Premier League meeting this Monday.
I find it slightly insulting that certainly, you know, supporters of other teams, and as Brighton have come, because Barber's been so public about his opinions, that we've kind of been singled out as, like, you know, the sort of naysaying, you know.
Well, Aston Villa have joined in.
Party people.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's pretty insulting. It's like, you know, if we're going to do this thing and you want it to finish, then it has to be done as properly as it possibly could.
Yeah.
Not just some sort of novelty exhibition tournament that actually will have consequences for, you know, for
clubs, yeah.
You know, what do you want? You want the football to continue, then have it as properly as you possibly can. Don't sort of do
it's
this.
It's like watching those under-17 World Cup tournaments in Toulon where you've got, you know, an empty stadium. You've got some reasonable football, but, you know, there's no atmosphere at all. They are playing out a game of football. Whereas, you know, to take AD's point aside a little bit, where football isn't a TV show, but the point is that when you do have a full stadium, then it makes for a good spectacle. You've got people watching. And that's what part of this sort of like this voyeuristic thing of I mean, like you, for instance, Andy, you'll go to the cinema to watch a live version of an opera because you can't get the ticket. So it's, you know, it's, but you're still, it doesn't have the same enjoyment, but you also know that there is something that people want to see and want to take part in. You're not going to want to not watch an opera that's taking place in an empty theatre.
Well, no.
Yeah, but it opens up the fourth wall, doesn't it? So
yeah, but I think that's a reasonable comparison actually, because you know, those shows are very good.
Mm.
But
the audience interaction is actually a major part of it. It's not a TV experience. When you're there, one of the reasons we love going to football all the time is because you're part of the interaction. The players play well, the audience pipes up. The audience pipes up, the players play better. And it's a circle that, you know, it's a spiral that sort of increases and also decreases. Once a player starts playing badly, out come the moans and the groans. So it's an interactive part of it.
Well, it's a 12th man, isn't it? So it's being part of it. It's being part of the,
well,
the
it's more than that,
occasion, backing your team. I mean, you know, I mean, if you let's look at the before all this hit, let's look at a couple of games that happened at the homes of some of our bottom-dwelling rivals, as it were.
Beautiful way of putting it, Aidy. Thanks for that.
But I didn't want to say relegation, but
basement level,
yeah. All right. But the, you know, you've got Liverpool who are taking on all comers this season. They've swept the league aside. Went through the season unbeaten. Rocked up at Watford recently, and they lost 3-0. Now, you know, obviously, that's. I'm not going to say that's necessarily due to home advantage. I mean, they probably do it back in anyway, but it helps having those supporters behind them, willing them on. And, you know, for those Watford supporters, that will be that. They'll be still be talking about that now because it was a wonderful.
It shows that you can be as good as you can be, but ultimately. It's human. It's human nature. You know that Liverpool have to be on their game every single game. Yeah. They've got the team they're playing at rock, you know, near the bottom of the table, and they
get, Al, you've also got
a human element to it.
You've also got the all conquering Man City side from last season. They turned up at Carrow Road and got beaten 5-2. You know, it's you know, these things happen. It happens a lot where. You don't see the smaller sides, for want of a better phrase, going to the bigger sides and causing an upset that often. But on their home turf, it happens a hell of a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, Arsenal versus Brighton in December, absolutely. But yeah. I do have to get back to another point about the whole fan thing. We've got the unpredictability of a football league, although you've got certain on. So let's face it, if it's highly probable that given the regular set of circumstances, Liverpool will win this league. I think everyone would agree that, and I think that people just want Liverpool to win the league if they're going to do it in the manner that is fairest and most open and most transparent and most regular towards how the football season could and should be going. No one's got that problem. But when we're talking about whether we can do it and whether the players should be, you know, isolated or 2 meters and all that sort of stuff, and yet here we are then talking about the whole notion of football without fans is nothing. How many people have actually said, well, look, how on earth are you going to get the fans in there? You know, you cannot have both. So, you know, the problem that absolutely everyone has is that there is no perfect solution, or rather, there's certainly no perfect solution at the moment.
You've also got the other thing, Newcastle as an example. You know, they were due to be coming down here this weekend. And, you know, even if they're playing it at the Amex, which is obviously what we would want to happen, where would they stay? Because there's no hotels open. Okay, let's leave that one there then. And just remember that you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I am joined here today in our isolation tanks by Andy Bass, Marcus Hancock, Phil Shelley, and of course Alan Wares. I'm AD Packham. Now, Phil Shelley, as you may know, is our wonderful sponsor from oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil, you have got a shirt of the week for us. Are you going to model it?
I'm not going to model it. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to show it to you and see if any of you can guess who it is. I'd be very surprised, although you might.
Okay.
And we'll do a little...
I know what it is, so I can't guess.
We'll do a little close-up with the camera, have a look at it, and then I've got some words to go with it, if that's what you'd like.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can I just point out that those of you listening to this either on the podcast or on Radio Reverb, we are actually doing this on Zoom, recording this on Zoom. So we've got the advantage of super reverb vision. So you're going to have to describe it as... I think if we leave Andy and Marcus to describe the shirt. So, Phil, knock yourself out. What's your shirt of the week?
Here it is.
Right, wow. Andy, Marcus, do you want to describe that?
It's absolutely white, primarily, made by Nike, sponsored by the Hard Rock Cafe. It's got colours across the midriff. I'll let Andy take over the rest of it.
Okay, so it's...
I've just seen what you've done to the badge, Phil. That's genius.
It's
like for those listening to it on Reverb, Phil has actually stuck a bit of paper over the badge.
So yellow and green band across the middle with the Hard Rock logo, Hard Rock Hotel logo in it. I'm guessing that might be some Florida-based team. So I'm going to go for like whatever version of the Tampa Bay Rowdies is still going, if they are still a thing.
What makes you think it's Florida?
It's got Seminole written across the top of the badge.
Ah, and I've just seen...
There's the reveal.
Florida State. We were kind of like Tallahassee, I think. But oh, there we go.
We are. Yes.
For those of you not watching the video, Phil has removed the piece of paper to reveal the name of the badge, which is
Tampa Bay Rowdies.
Okay, Phil, over to you, mate. Tell us about this shirt.
It's a great shirt.
Okay, I like it. Right, this is a recent addition to my collection. It's the 2017 away shirt of the Tampa Bay Rowdies. The Rowdies play in the United Soccer League, which is the second tier of soccer football in the States. And that's the USL. You can see the badge on the sleeve there. Mm-hmm. It's actually a player's shirt, hence it's got the Stars and Stripes on it as well. The current Rowdies team is actually a resurrected version of the side that played in the NASL in the late 70s through to 84. The original side won the NASL in 75 and they were runners-up in 78 and 79. Back in those days, they played in the Tampa Stadium, capacity 71,000.
Wow.
They regularly had crowds in excess of 45,000 at matches. The highest one they ever had was in 1980 against the California Surf, 56,389 people. The NASL was considerably more popular than the MLS is. Not a lot of people appreciate
that. Do we know why, Phil?
Nah, probably because people like Beckenbauer and Cruyff and people like that played there, but more of that.
LA.
George Best. Rodney Marsh.
Peter Ward.
You're taking all my bits. So shut up. Right. NASL collapsed in 84, but the team carried on playing in whatever guise of soccer existed in the States. And actually finishing playing indoor soccer, which they then folded in 94. In 2008, the name was resurrected when a group of local businessmen decided to start a new professional football team in Tampa. And after a lot of wrangling over the naming rights, they played their first official game in early 2010. The game was in the league that was then called the USSF Division II. And the team they played was Crystal Palace Baltimore,
which I think was
a Simon Jordan thing when he was running Palace. I think he bought it to sort of like, you know, the old joint venture type thing, a little bit like Man City are doing all around the world, I suppose. The good news is Tampa Bay Rowdies won 1-0. Yeah.
Hey.
Right, so since the transition went to the NASL again, it was called for a while. And now it's the USL Championship. They finished last season in fifth place. Nowadays, they play at the slightly more modest 7,500 capacity Al Lang Stadium, which is in St. Petersburg, just over the water from Tampa. So it's still on the Tampa Bay. It's not difficult finding UK links to the Tampa Bay Rowdies, but let's just start with Joe Cole, made 82 appearances before hanging up his boots 2 years ago.
Wow.
And Neil Collins, who was with Sheffield United for years, he played similar period, 2016 to 2018. But if you go back to the original incarnation of the side, you'll find Rodney Marsh, thank you, made 100 appearances for the side and captained them. Tommy Smith spent a few months there on loan from Liverpool in 76. And Lenny Glover made 32 appearances. Would you believe it? Roy Wegerle began his professional career at the Tampa Bay Rowdies before he moved to the UK.
Wow.
And I can think of one link to the Albion. Peter Ward played a total of 22 games for the team. And then 23 times for the Tampa Bay Terror, which was an indoor soccer team, before he finally hung up his boots and retired. Go on then. Who knows when Peter Ward retired from playing professional football? What year?
I've actually got the answer written down here, so I can't.
Well, shut up then.
1985.
Just because you said 85, I'm going to say 86.
I'm going to go 84.
1997.
Shut up, AD! 1997, at the age of 42, was when Mr. Ward finished playing professional football.
Well, where was he at Hereford then?
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. That is the shirt
of the
week.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Phil.
Thank you for that, Phil. And of course, oldfootballshirts.com is an online gallery of how many shirts is there on there now? 107,000?
7,000 something.
That's pretty impressive. Most of them look like they're behind you.
Well, I have to say, if anyone at the Albion is watching this, rip that shirt off.
Yeah, it's nice. And actually, let me be clear here. My pet hate, look, this is not stuck on. This is a bespoke shirt made for a team that plays in a 7,500 capacity stadium.
By Nike.
Nike, you can do it. That is in the early runner for shirt of the year for me.
That was a nice segue there, Andy, because we have got, obviously, well, we haven't got any events coming up at the moment, clearly, because we're not allowed to go anywhere. But
the night's a bit thin, isn't it?
So obviously the rent game's off. All games are off. But I mean, just something for you. I mean, someone did say to me the other day, said, I can now see why you've got a face for radio. And now why you do a radio show. And as you may notice, we have been busy. We have been putting out some content over on our YouTube channel. It's got a show called Shirt of Our Years. Marcus and Phil have already done one. Andy's got one. We'll probably be doing one shortly as well. But we've also had the aforementioned Peter Ward has popped up. Gary Dicker. We've had Paul Camden, the Albion Press, to do one. We've had Lou Englefield come do one. It's been we've got a lot to, a few more lined up to do as well. So that's on our YouTube channel. Please go and have a look. They're good, aren't they, Al?
They are very good. I mean, the presenters are fantastic.
First one was good.
Yeah, it's all about the guests, really. But
yeah, definitely.
Is that why you haven't done one yet, Andy?
Yeah, exactly.
But but yeah, no, I mean, it was some interesting stuff, and actually, it was one of those that got me thinking about the next topic here. When I was talking to Gary Dicker, and he chose, and the shirt that he chose was the fluorescent green and black away shirt, which we wore the first season at the Amex.
We wore it everywhere except the Amex.
Yeah, well, indeed. Actually, we did wear it at the Amex, I think, because I think Harty wore that in the
Cup final. He did.
Classic Senior Cup final. Yeah.
Funny enough, he wouldn't let me have that shirt.
Strange that.
That sounds like an 8-year sulk, Phil.
Not at all. I've got a bad.
But whilst I was talking to Gary about and the reasons that he chose that, we were talking about who was the best player to actually wear that shirt that he played with. And after some consideration, of course, he went with Vicente, who was one of our wonderful imports that we've actually had. And we're very, very lucky to have him. Well, I would have liked to have seen more of him. I think he might have fallen out of Gus a little bit or out of favour. But he was certainly very, very popular with the players, Gary was telling us. And very much involved in the dressing room banter with his very limited English. But I mean, he was an absolutely wonderful, so a wonderful foreign player that we've had come and play for the Albion. So, but who are the other ones? Who are the best imports that we've had come and play for us? Obviously, we're going to look at Colde, we're going to look at Orlandi, but let's go all the way back to probably the first one that I remember, Marcus, and that was Sergei Gotsmanov.
Yeah, that was exactly who I was going to say, actually. Stolen my thunder there.
I love the way that AD answers the question for you.
Yeah, I know. It's great, isn't it? Yeah, name the giant ape in King Kong. Yeah, exactly. It's that sort of thing.
Well, tell us about Gotsmanov. And unless you want to choose someone else, Marcus, but tell us about Gotsmanov.
Let's paint the picture. It's sort of, you know, sort of late 80s, you know, football's in a bit of a doldrums. It's before, you know, Italian 90, which kind of, you know, and before the Premier League and everything like that. So, you know, a little bit, you know, Barry Lloyd team, we were sort of toiling in the second division. We'd just been promoted from the third. And, you know, we never really, you know, Russia was still, you know, behind the Iron Curtain at that point. You know, the Cold War had sort of started to thaw. I mean, they came from actually Belarus, which is now not part of the old Soviet Union. But of course, he was a Soviet Union CCCP International, played in Euro 88. And for some reason, God knows how, Barry Lloyd managed to sign this Sergei Gotsmanov fella who, you know, bearing in mind, there's probably only about 8,000 people at the Golds at that point. But my God, what a player. He had everything. He had skills, he had goals, he got a sponsored larder from the local dealership, which...
There was a lot of charisma as well, wasn't there?
I mean, he was expecting a better Western car and he gets saddled with a larder. And, you know, when you look at the YouTube footage, remember him sort of rounding, I think it was a Hull City goalkeeper and he stuck his hands up before he put the ball in the net. I mean, the guy was absolute quality. And we only had him for like 10 games. And don't get me started
with South Africa,
one of my bete noirs, but they signed him as a back up to Matthew Letizia, and it was kind of like, brilliant, thanks for that, Southampton. We'd already agreed a fee, and I think they did offer 10 grand more. And also, there was a time when Ipswich signed, I think it's Sergei Beltacha, who's the father of the tennis player. Yeah. And they both played, I think they either Beltacha came on a sub for Ipswich or something like that, but there was a game, I think it was at Portman Road, where they both played at the same time. And that's the first time in English football that two Soviet players. Yeah.
The thing is, at the time, Eastern European was one great big block. I mean, you think, you're okay, it doesn't matter if you're Yugoslav, you're Bulgarian, you're Polish, you're Russian, you're a commie.
Yeah. Well, one of the first players to come over here was Vladimir Petrovic, who was playing for Arsenal. Obviously, you had the Argentinians as well. You had Ricky Villa and Ozzy Ardiles at Spurs, who were obviously wonderful footballers.
Well, we nearly signed a couple of Peruvians straight after the 78 World Cup. I mean, maybe that Mullery had been inspired by Keith Birkinshaw getting Villa and Ardiles, because we nearly signed a couple of Peruvians. In fact, one of those who was a star in beating Scotland in the 78 World Cup. I want to say Cubias, but he was a boxer, wasn't it? Who am I thinking of?
It is Cubias.
It was Percy. It was Percy Rojas and someone Cubias. Maybe someone listening could fill us in on that.
Cubias, okay. He's the guy that scored that.
Are we talking about foreign players that didn't sign for us now?
Actually, Phil, just go.
I'm just talking about great free kicks against Scotland in the World Cup.
Yeah. Phil, just to go slightly off topic here, the Peru kit is often like voted as one of the best in football. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a lovely kit. This is the red sash, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's because it's simple. It always looks the same. If you think about it, any time you've ever seen that kit in photos or watching them actually on a World Cup match or something like that, it's always the same. You know, Argentina have fiddled around with darker bits on their kit and like a T-bar on their kit. England have had the red stripes across the top. Germany,
yeah, Argentinian kit,
orange, yellow zigzag on it and stuff. They always change, but actually the Peruvian shirt never has. And actually, it's made by, or it historically was made by a really decent brand as well, Waylon, and they just looked good. They were proportioned right.
Jennings,
they were cut right? Huh?
Waylon Jennings.
Just Waylon. Waylon. I just think they were, it probably is, I mean, for me, I think international football shirts are an odd thing because it sounds daft. A shirt without a sponsor on looks weird to me nowadays. And of course, international shirts don't carry sponsors. You've got weird and wonderful ones. Now you've got a lot of the smaller countries are sort of having outrageous shirts. The Khalifa teams, they either
Phil, this is your thing, your specialist subjects. Tell us, we'll get on to Albion Imports in a minute, but tell us about Khalifa.
Khalifa is the Confederation of Independent Football Associations. They are football associations that are not recognised by FIFA. Mm-hmm. And they organised their own European and World Championships. They had the World Football Cup in 2018 was played in South London, or around London. Went along the games there. And their countries, anything from countries like the Turkish Republic and Northern Cyprus. You've got Szekeland, which is a region of Hungary. You've got...
Cascadia.
You've got Cascadia, which is a region that crosses over the Canadian-American border just north of Seattle.
Sealand in that?
Sealand?
Yeah, the little fort off the Norfolk coast. My friend Sam used to play for Sealand. He always said he was an international. Godalming's ground against these sort of teams that are not part of FIFA. Like Tibet or whatever.
Yeah. Well, the thing that happens with Khalifa is teams come and go quite a lot, either for politics or finance. So, for example, Yorkshire have a team in it. The Isle of Man.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Cornwall have just joined it.
Jersey on there as well.
Jersey is Jersey and Khalifa. Because it is so fluid, it really does change on an annual basis. So, I think they are not at the moment, but when they organise the tournaments, I mean, they have to make sure that the teams can all raise a team and raise the finance to go to the tournaments, you know. So from one tournament to another, the teams really do vary. Was Bulawayo, Zimbabwe, isn't it? They had a team, a guy wrote about it called One Football No Nets, where he went over to Zimbabwe to bring a team to the Khalifa World Cup in 2018, and he documents all the hoops he's got to go through. He's got to raise you know, money and get visas for people who don't even have passports or birth certificates, you know. But Khenifa, it's becoming more popular. I think it was good that they played it in London because that gave it a bit of exposure. Hmm. But that said, I mean, I've watched footage of games where it's almost like watching a match behind closed doors. So there you go.
One day they'll have the People's Republic of Brighton Hove, I'm sure. But let's get back on track.
Actually, Phil, this is something which I do need to talk to you about, actually, because I mean, we're talking about this on our WhatsApp group this week. And there's been a shirt that's going for a stupid amount of money at the moment, which is a shirt from 84, 85, I think it is. And they're saying it was a match-worn shirt by Hans Kraaij. Do you want to just put some meat on the bones on that one?
Well, Hans Kraaij never wore number 6 in that season. I think it was worn by Gatting for pretty much the entire season, for a start. So it's a number 6 shirt. It's lovely. I mean, it certainly is a match shirt. There's no question that it's a match shirt. I don't think he's going to get 1,800 quid for it somehow. I think that's a little bit steep for a Brighton and Hove Albion match shirt.
What year is that shirt for Defner?
It's the 83-84, the season after the Cup final, 83-84.
Yeah, it's got the FA Cup finalist embroidery on it.
But there is one match he did wear the number 6 at home to Middlesbrough at the end of that season.
Right at the end of the season, yes, you're absolutely right. There was a game at the end of the season that he wore number 6. But for the majority, bear in mind, in those days, that shirt would have been worn all season long.
This is what's left of Tim Carter's book.
Exactly.
Let's go back on topic then. Let's talk about Hans Kraaij.
Is he one of our great imports? He's one of our funniest.
I loved him. He was absolutely wonderful. Marcus?
Bit before my time, I'm afraid, AD.
Bit before Andy's time, bit before Phil's time. So okay. you're going to have to come back to me. Yeah, he was a lunatic. Came over here having been on 11-match ban for pushing over the referee. Why that ban didn't apply when he came to England, I've no idea, because it would do nowadays. But yeah, he pushed over or twatted a referee, probably for, I don't know, who knows what reason. But yeah, came over here. One was famous for two main things. One, for doing the Zebedee impression in front of the goalkeeper, which Chris Catlin strongly encouraged to do so. And two, noted for also getting engaged to a woman he'd met 3 days before in a nightclub.
Brilliant.
and to be fair, stayed married to for 12 years.
I do believe I did see him play. I have a feeling I might have seen him play away at Oxford United.
Right.
As one particular game. But I think he was, I mean, truth be told, he wasn't that good.
No, he was an athlete, that's all.
A small amount of games. What, he scored 2 or 3 goals or something? I mean, he really wasn't that impressive, but I just think those little things that he did, like you just described there, and I think there was, he was a sort of one of those sort of iconic, legendary players that, you know, he's a legend in the club, even though he was by no means the best player we had that season. Substitute for most games, he came on as a sub for most of his games for us.
Yes, he did.
You know, but that shirt, I mean, yeah, it's a lovely shirt. It may have been worn by him at the end of the season, but it would have been worn by Gatting for the rest of the season. Sure. There's a goal in the Korean game.
Okay, Andy.
Andy, let's go across to you, mate, because you've been here for a mere 20 years as an Albion fan. What's your greatest import? Because when we were talking basically with Dean and Amex era, aren't we?
I would say my favourite import was kind of like the Spanish invasion that we had under Gus Poyet.
Yeah.
So that time when we had Caudi, Bruno, Spanish Dave, Orlandi.
Sure.
And Joa later on. But when we had that Latin, just as a collective as well, I mean, all great players in their own individual right. But what I liked about that group of players is it really changed the culture of the club. They were greater than the sum of the parts in terms of how they helped us refashion our image, and certainly how Gus changed our image, changed our style of football, and laid the foundations for where we are now. And I think those players were crucial.
I like still seeing the Gaviota's banner in the southwest corner every game, which is a relic from that era. And that was a fun time to watch the Albion because we were very successful, but we played with a sort of a panache and flair that we weren't really used to with Dean. So different characters, there's a different style, and it allowed us to progress into this modern club that we now have. Mm. And and they played a big part of it. And I think the way that the fan base took to the whole Spanish thing, we had Spanish days, we were taking Basque flags to Middlesbrough to support Coldy, and we just changed the way that we thought about ourselves. And I think that it's rare for a group of players to have such a big cultural impact on a football
and team. Yet how well easily they integrated with the rest of the squad. It's not as though they were a clique on their own. When you think of the Dutch players at Rangers with their own clique once upon a time, this lot were very much woven into the fabric of the club and the city.
I think also it actually it was probably a bit of a masterstroke by Tony Bloom and Gus Poyet doing it as well, because what it did is it generated a huge amount of interest in the club. And if you think, all the days, so as you said, when we get the Amex, it'll be 14,000 on a good day. And we've managed to basically fill it for pretty much every game. Mm. And I think them being there and that, the end of the with Dean, with Colday and Gus coming along and then going into the Amex and then building on that Spanish contingent or Spanish-speaking contingent, I just think it just kept people coming back and it made sure that ground was full from day one.
It's interesting what you're talking about with the Spanish contingent, because and Andy mentioned about sort of Gus getting them together, because I was going to say my greatest import is Gus. Yeah. And the reasons that Andy just mentioned there, he's the architect of where we are now. It was such a major gear crunch between, I mean, Russell Slade partially, but Mickey Adams before that, it was a world of difference between the two. He's the architect of where we're at. We played football completely differently. I'm even looking at the with Dean years, which is up on YouTube now, the last season. We're playing this football in the third division, which actually does suit the Premier League. All right, we're playing against third division opposition. But for me, Gus was the greatest import because of the legacy which he has left behind and continues to leave behind.
And changing the culture of the club.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I was thinking more from a player's perspective, but Gus was and it's nice to say something nice about Gus Poyet now, because I think we've got enough distance in the rearview mirror to really appreciate
how it ended at the time, to be honest.
It ended rather bitterly, didn't it?
And that's the shame, isn't it?
And I'm very sad about that, because you're absolutely right. I mean, he basically put the foundations in for where we are now. Mm. It was an absolutely crucial appointment, and definitely worthy of being top of this list.
So, Phil, down to you, mate. Who's your greatest Albion import?
I was actually thinking Gus Poyet myself as well.
Sorry.
But I'll try it now. I just think Dirk Laban, just for his
way. It's not Lorenzo Pinamonti, is it? Let's put it that way. Marcus, talk to us about Christian Baz and Augustin Batapiedi.
Without swearing.
Lazy. They were probably not one of Gus's more successful Spanish speaking imports. No. It's fair to say. It was Christian Baz that dinked the penalty over in the Woking FA Cup game, which, to be fair, he had the co-Jones to do it. Batapiedi was just lazy, basically. Yeah. There's no way. Actually, just going back to Sergei Beltatry, he was Ukrainian. So it's two players from the Soviet Union at the time, as when the Soviet Union existed.
Well, as much as we'd like to continue this conversation, and we probably will into the afternoon, that we are running out of time. So I just want to say thank you to all of our guests today, to Phil Shelley, to Andy Baston, Marcus Hancock, of course, to Alan Wears. I've been Andy Packham. This has been the Albion Raw. We'll try and be back as often as we can. Now we can. And don't forget to look out for the shirts of our years, which we've got. They're over on our YouTube channel. And they're good fun. And all of our guests have been absolutely wonderful. So enjoy those. This has been the Albion Raw. See you again next time. The next one. Bye.